Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 13 with Wicklow-based breeder William Micklem. In addition to being a successful breeder of Olympic event horses, William is also an author, a coach, an inventor, and much more. William is also one of very few people who holds the distinction of being a fellow of the British Horse Society. You've enjoyed success as a breeder, a coach, author, inventor, and many more. But was there ever a point in your life where you considered a professional life or career outside of the horse industry?
I did indeed. I went off to London, and I considered the financial world to begin with, and then I went into the property world, and I worked for a small firm in the centre of London, and then I worked for a much bigger firm, which I'm not going to mention names, because as I grew up, I was aware that certain people had perceptions about horse dealers, and my father was a horse dealer, and they were put in the same bracket as car dealers. And so I picked up on this negative perception. And it wasn't until I went to work in the property business that I found out what dishonesty and corruption was all about. And I realized that probably the horse world was much healthier than I had possibly imagined it to be. And I took a period of study leave, which I had for my surveying exams. I hadn't ridden for 3 years. And that was also to do with a fall I'd had pointing. And I went and started riding again for those 3 weeks. And at the end of those 3 weeks, I took my BHSI, which is the British Horse Society Instructor's Exam, and was delighted to pass it. And I suppose that set me down a road which hasn't changed very much.
And roughly what sort of age bracket were you at that point?
21.
Of all those various hats that you've worn from that point in time until now, which do you identify most passionately with?
That's a very difficult question to answer. People tend to do things which they're good at. And from an early stage, it was obvious that I had certain communication skills and knowledge which made me a good coach. And passing the BHSI exam is primarily a coaching exam. So I was sent off down that road. I probably was not sufficiently aware that I could do coaching in a wider world, not just the horse world. Now, in recent years, first of all, with Sport Ireland and the coaching structure that Horse Sport Ireland joined into with, I think, 57 other sports, that sort of cross-fertilization with the other sports has helped me diversify. And now I would work with more people from other sports, and I would work especially with young people who are not from any sport. They're just young people who want to improve their performance. That I find the most satisfying now.
What prompted your initial move to Ireland?
I had been in America running an equestrian center in New England, and my visa ran out. Okay. I had a very good party that night. And I didn't leave on time. I was one day late. And next time I applied for a visa, they had it in their little book. Anyway, so I had to leave. And so I was back home in Cornwall, where I was born.
Yeah.
Very horsey county. It used to be the top horse breeding county in the whole of England. And then it became number two to Lincolnshire. Anyway, I was at home in Cornwall. And I got a call from Pat Manning, who was a fellow of the British Horse Society, and she was doing some work with what was Board McGoppel in those days, and said they're looking for somebody to join John Hall, who married Iris Kellett subsequently, to come to Ireland. So I had an interview, and they hired me, and I came over to Ireland.
And did you ever consider fleeing again?
Do you know, the horse world is, as you know yourself, if you're involved with horses, it's a great passport as long as you can come to the language to go around the world. So I've never felt restricted. And without a doubt, I couldn't have gone anywhere in the world that was better in terms of an overall attitude, not just to horses, but to people as well. And I often say that, you know, there are three, I look upon us having three interlinked golden rules in the horse world. And number one is that it's all about people, and that the riders, the breeders, coaches, everybody, you have to, no matter how brilliant you are, no matter how special you are, unique you are, etc., you have to learn people skills. And number one in those is the importance of positivity, keeping things simple and positive, because positivity builds, negativity kills. And I'm sure you're aware of it, how a person who's encouraging, a person who realizes that we all start from zero, a person who understands that we can't all be perfect initially, if you can encourage that person, if you can encourage the students, you can do extraordinary things. And as people develop their people skills, then it all becomes part of what I call Team Ireland, with all the associations working together. And I suppose that's my other second golden link, is that it's all about the sport. And the more successful the sport is, the more successful the breeders are going to be and everybody else is going to be. You know, we're looking at it from a breeding perspective. It's very important that the sport is a success. And we all have a responsibility to get involved in that. And again, that comes back to what I call Team Ireland. And my third thing that underpins it all is that it's all about horses. And therefore, we have to treat horses not as machines, but we have to treat them humanely. And that is a major problem, particularly in the elite horse world. I remember seeing a headline in the, I think it was the Horse and Hound or something like that, saying, the headline was, are horses too valuable to turn out? And I flipped through the Horse and Hound and I thought, but obviously they're not too valuable to turn out. They must be turned out. Horses should be turned out. But no, contrary to what I expected, they said, yes, they're too valuable. There are too many risks of turning them out. And I think it's one of the most wonderful things about Ireland is that we have space.
Yeah.
You know, and especially in comparison with two of our major competitors in Holland and in Belgium, we have an ability to turn our horses out. And I think it's so important that we allow our horses to be horses. But what do we get? We get horses left alone in stables. It's what I call the three I's that they suffer from. They suffer from isolation because they don't have enough contact either from other horses or people. They suffer from inactivity because they spend too many hours doing nothing. And even then, when they do our work, they work for too short a time. And they suffer from injury, particularly because a horse is actually not super designed to carry a rider. Now, horses have problems in the back. And we had to get our education right so that even like simple things, everybody should do a balanced rising trot so they don't put their horse through absolute hell and forcing them to put their backs down. But we don't do enough to guarantee that from the youngest level. And we don't do enough with our young horse training to ensure that they come through their backs. They might have either in reality or potentially great jumping ability or great this and great that, but if they drop in their backs, it's absolutely useless. And if I can give one example on that, Mandiba and High Kingdom, two full brothers, both went to the Olympics and both went to the World Equestrian Games, but quite different in the way that they went initially as young horses. So with Mandiba, after 3 days, he was through in his back, you know, lifting his back, connected 3 days on the lunge, connected from the back end to the front end, ready to be ridden. With High Kingdom, it took six months of patient lunging to get him through in his back before he could be ridden. Because in my opinion, if we'd ridden High Kingdom before he was through in his back, then you close the door to that connection from the back end to the front end. I see so many horses that cannot progress because their backs are dropped. Maybe their heads and necks are pulled in, but their backs are still dropped and they don't get anywhere.
With bringing the discussion onto Mandiba and High Kingdom, you've brought me nicely on to your foundation mare, High Dolly. Will you talk us through how you first came to find High Dolly and what drew you to her initially, or made you decide you had to buy her?
Yes, I can't quite tell you everything, but I'll tell you most.
Without getting anyone in trouble, or
I was engaged to advise the Ennis Showground committees about the development of Ennis Showgrounds. One, Ennis is, you've probably been there, absolutely wonderful, wide group of horsey people. And I duly prepared my plan for presentation, and I went down there and I went in for the meeting. But after a few minutes of the meeting, it became apparent that they were not ready to hear my presentation because there was not total agreement about the direction they should take. So I went out to the bar and I said, if you want me, give me a call back in, but I'll stay out there for half an hour. So I went to the bar. There was only the barman and one other man at the bar. And the barman asked what I was doing. I explained, and he said, well, you should talk to this man because he's got a friend who's got a horse for sale. And so I talked to this man and he said, listen, it's 5 minutes down the road. And I said, well, I've got to go back to this meeting probably. He said, no, come on, it's only 5 minutes. He'll be back in course of an hour. So I get in the back of this white van, and 15 minutes later, we're going down this very narrow, very bumpy road in a direction I did not know where. And I was beginning to think, now, was this a stupid decision?
Is this the end?
Anyway, we arrived at this place and he said, listen, I'm going to shine my lights down the drive. And at the end of the drive is a garage with a roll top door. And you lift that up, that's where the mare is. So I went down, walked down the drive. I lifted up the roll top door and there blinking in the headlights was this little mare. And that's where she'd been for a good amount of time probably, but well looked after. So we took her out and the man went and we put her on a rope. The mare was in the field. The man was on the roadside. I can't explain totally why, but anyway. So I stood on the bank and watched her go up and down. And I loved her from the beginning. And 3 days later, I came down and rather gave the game away because I had the trainer on the back of the car that tried her in the indoor school. And we bought her and took her home. And one of the things that attracted me most of all about her, apart from her paces and jump, and she was only small, 15'3", and that she had, was the fact that it was her breeding, but there were no papers. Mm. But there was something about me that made me think that this the breeding was correct, because they said that she was by chairlift out of a pre-ferry mare, both of which excited me.
Yeah.
She had won 4 points, which I later saw on the video. She was extraordinary from the start. She had this wonderful gentleness, but also this tremendous courage. And I think that's one of the things that made her such an outstanding broodmare, the mental side.
The follow-on to that was, I was going to ask, what do you think of her characteristics she passed on most dominantly to her offspring?
I talk about the three B's needed in an event horse, and they should have brain, they should have brawn, and they should have beauty. But undoubtedly it was her brain that was most special. And I think when we look at a horse under those headings, brain, brawn, and beauty, we spend an inordinate amount of time looking at the beauty of the horse. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's the external beauty of the horse more than the internal beauty. And I'm talking about physical. Yeah. Because, as you know, research is increasingly showing that if you can have a look at the heart and look at the size of the heart at an early stage, it gives a real indication whether they can be performance horses, particularly for racing and eventing. And then the other thing we can't see is inside their head, but you can get indications from an early stage. But I think without doubt it was that was what it was with Dolly. And then the other thing about her was that it was obvious she had three good paces. Now, I differ from many people who say, particularly in regard to eventing, that you have a good walk and a good canter, the trot doesn't matter because we can make a good trot. I don't believe that that's as black and white. And in these more competitive days, I think you've got to have a good trot. One of the reasons why I was attracted by Master Imp when I saw him is that, in my opinion, he had an international trot. And he had the sort of trot that in the future would collect and do Piaf and Passage, as well as having a wonderful extended trot. He had three fantastic paces. Dolly had three fantastic paces, and Dolly also had great jumping technique, including being able to open up behind, which is not something that everybody is aware of with event horses, that she could open up behind.
Just when you mentioned Master Imp there, when you're looking for thoroughbred stallions to use in your own breeding program, how do you assess those thoroughbred stallions in terms of both their conformation and in terms of their pedigree? Because I think often, especially the pedigree element of assessing thoroughbreds, is something that's overlooked.
I have absolutely no doubt that it's overlooked. Good paces are very important, and you can tell straight away whether they're athletic. You know, I was sent a video of a thoroughbred horse that's just joined the stallion cohort internationally recently, and beautifully bred, beautiful looking horse, but it's obvious from the videos that the horse is not athletic. He's not an athlete, so it's not worth the risk as far as I'm concerned. And looking at that horse's breeding, he was largely sprinter bred. And if there's anything that my research has shown up, it's that the performance horses, both in show jumping and whoever thoroughbred element, and in eventing, it comes from the horses that do well at a mile and a half, and in days gone by, a mile and three quarters, in other words, the slightly longer distances. So I would look at the pedigree. So as you know, there's just been a new stallion licensed by the Holstein Verband called Inen Minster, which is exciting because he's gone through proper testing and he's a very good looking horse and he's got athleticism. But when you look at his genetics, he's by a horse called Masterstroke, who won over 500,000 on the flat. And he was a mile and a half horse, and he's absolutely beautiful. And he was third in the Arc. And Masterstroke is by Monson, mm-hmm. who was the leading sire for 4 years in Germany and has a huge record for producing steeplechase horses. He himself won over 2 million. And the dam was second in the Irish Oaks and third in the English Oaks. And on the dam side, the dam is a full sister of a Group One horse. And she is by Lando, who's champion 2 and 3 year old colt himself, who's by Akantendango, who is a German legend on the race course, the only horse to have won the Triple Crown. So what I'm saying is that here we have a horse for the sport horse world who's close up bred to some wonderful mile and a half genes. And then you go further back and you go back to the sort of genes that are coming up all the time, my favorite genes, whether it's Blandford or Hyperion or Precipitation, whoever it is, these old gods of the performance world. So that excites me. I think there is a real value in looking back 2, 3, 4, and 5 generations to see what you've got there.
Definitely. And with that horse's pedigree, I'd need to look it up again. I'd need to see it in front of me. But one thing that was actually a relief to me was that his pedigree wasn't heavily dominated with multiple crosses of Northern Dancer and Mr. Prospector. And it mightn't be popular. I'm sure there'll be some people that'll listen to this, and especially if they have a horse at home who ticks these boxes. But there does seem to be a correlation between horses that have 2 and 3 and more crosses of Northern Dancer and Mr. Prospector in terms of their inability to produce successful offspring in the sport horse world. And I think the challenge is on finding horses that are either free or not as heavily dominated by those genetics, that have the athleticism themselves, the traits themselves, that we are hoping that their sport horse offspring will have.
Yeah, I think genetic diversity is important. And I think we have a problem in the thoroughbred world and in the non-thoroughbred world. One of the reasons why I chose Master Imp, just assessing the two horses genetically, High Dolly and Master Imp, was it would mean that I would have genes from the three so-called foundation sires, particularly from Matcham, which is very, very rare in the racing world today. So you have their blood of the three foundation sires, and that's very important. Tiger Roll is an example of an extraordinary little horse who comes from the Northern Dancer line, I think, on both sides. But I think the jury is slightly out, but what can't be good is that there is an imbalance going down one line and one line only. That's not good at all. Having said that, I have seen, I've recently seen some wonderful horses that, you know, I've over the years, I was particularly interested in racing. So you'd watch the Mill Reefs of this world and get very excited with them. Shirley Heights, and Shirley Heights is a horse which keeps coming back up in the sport horse world now. And I should have used Garib because we've got the Shirley Heights there. But anyway, there are special horses, and you just see them, albeit on the television, they just have that athleticism. They have that looseness. You know, to me, that's very exciting. And I saw Wings of Eagles, who's by Paul Moir, down at Coolmore, and it, just as he is, you know, if you could have bought him as a sport horse then and there, you'd be on, you know, one of the most exciting horses you could possibly have. Three fantastic paces, great balance, and not too big, which is important. You know, it's going to come up in our conversation, I'm sure. You can't go eventing unless you have sufficient gallop. And the interesting thing is that in show jumping as well, you now have to go faster. You know, it's totally obvious that you have to go faster, and you have to be able to jump at speed without a lot of alterations.
Yeah, the classes are being won between the fences.
That's right. But it's, well, yes and no. The other thing about the fences is you have to be efficient over the fence.
Yeah.
Gilt Edge was a horse I was involved with, which was David O'Connor. You could not find a more efficient horse over a fence than Gilt Edge. And that's why a lot of people looked at him initially and said he's short of scope. He wasn't short of scope. He would just keep jumping. He was quick through the air, neat as a pin, fantastic for against the clock, except he didn't have to go against the clock, except across country. And it's one of the things that I worry about, the type of horses that we are using. And you mustn't let me forget, coming back to the question about the gallop, is one of the things that worries me is show jumping rules the roost. There's no doubt about that. 75% of the international horses come from show jumping, 15% come from eventing, and 10%, give or take 1%, come from dressage. Show jumping also rules the roost, therefore, numerically and in terms of value, in terms of the money that's in show jumping. So therefore, everybody wants to breed a show jumper. Therefore, I look at it from an eventing perspective, and I have to say, I want people in show jumping to breed a horse I hope will be an Olympic show jumper, but I also hope if it doesn't make the highest level, it will be a good event horse. And I think that's the way for Team Ireland to go, is flexibility of use is super important. But these horses that show an exaggerated jump over a fence, which is what everybody's looking for, and they do every part of the jump so-called perfectly, but in fact, what people tend to focus on are the use of the front legs and the use of the hind legs. They don't focus so much on the use of the back. And it's the use of the back which allows the horse to have the spring and allows the horse to be more efficient over the fence, which comes back to what I was saying about the training of the young horses. So if you want to win classes today, you have to be quick over the fence as well as quick between the fences. And the type of horse that gives an exaggerated jump, spending extra time in the air, may look very impressive to the customer, may look very impressive in a photograph, but it is disastrous for cross-country. They put themselves in all sorts of trouble and they waste time. So the type of gallop that you have, we're talking about going show jumping faster, we're talking about going cross country faster, it mustn't be too long. The old fashioned British National Hunt horse and some of the early horses that did so well for Britain in horse trials, they were long, what I call long, flat gallopers, and the stride got bigger and bigger and bigger. What you want is a horse that stays on its feet even when it's going faster. So Mandiba, I have a sort of 25-acre area where my young horses are turned out, and it's got a pretty steep hill on it. But no horse has ever come down that hill as easily and as balanced as Mandiba. And then when he went faster, whether it's going uphill or downhill, he would still be able to cope. His balance was fantastic. And one of the most exciting days of my life was the cross-country day at the 2012 Olympics.
Outside of your winning now, we don't want to get in trouble with Sarah here. the second right. one of the most exciting
horse times. That's legitimate.
I don't want to get anyone in trouble.
You probably remember that it was on a golf course at Greenwich. So very undulating, up and down, twisty, turny, no bit of flat ground anywhere. plus the fences, they were technical, but they weren't the most frightening in the world. Therefore, you had to go clear. And Yogi Breisner said to the team on the morning of the event, I discovered afterwards, on the morning of the cross country, he said the three Fs, fast, furious, and fearless. And that's what they were asked to do. On the television, I just saw, you know, there wasn't a lot of bite in that going and undulating. You saw the British riders do this, and I saw High Kingdom go lickety-split, making the time easily, but never losing his balance, never getting into that long, flat, horrible gallop. And I think that's sometimes misunderstood. I went to America to judge the Young Event Horse Championship 3 years ago now. And some people questioned me when I marked down the horses that were long and flat. And I said, well, that's the reason why. That's not what you want. And it's the same with a galloping racehorse. You know, the ones that are super balanced save a lot of energy, and they're light on the ground, and the stance time is shorter, and therefore they gallop much better. Secretariat, apparently, the American legend, had the shortest stance time that's been measured. In other words, he just touched the ground and flew away again. So he had the longest period of suspension. He didn't have quite the longest stride, but he wasn't unbalanced. And the same with Mill Reef, the same with Shirley Heights, the same with Blakeney, these type of horses. And they are the ones which go on to produce, or some of their genes will go on to produce the sport horses that we want. And that's why we don't want horses that are too big. So as you are probably aware, there are so many top show jumping horses, like the dearly beloved Lost Hickstead, you know, who were just fantastic at going fast, both over across the ground and over the fences, and yet also be clean.
Yeah. You've been a great advocate of the traditional Irish horse. You've worked a lot with the Traditional Irish Horse Association over the years. Do you see any ways that the foal market can be made more commercially viable for the grassroots breeders of traditional Irish horses? And I know that's a very difficult question, but I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, to me, it's quite simple. The foal market will always be a difficult market in our sport. It is changing quietly. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that Paul Schockemoeller told me that there could never be a foal market. And you know what's happening in Europe these days. So things have changed. But strength at the top is strength at the bottom. There can only be real success for the foal market if horses that are traditionally bred or part traditionally bred do better at a higher level and people understand their value. Now, on that, I would say I'm a great supporter of all horses, but I do believe strongly in diversity. And to me, it's just a total own goal if we let the traditional Irish horse fade away. So I like all horses. It's not just the traditional Irish horse. But I'm a fan of the traditional Irish horse for a number of reasons. And I suppose I've seen it time and time again in terms of their attitude, in terms of their brain. They just do extraordinary things. And we were very excited when we had a presentation from Professor Emmeline Hill last year, who has done some work, produced a paper which is about to be published. And she compared a body of traditional Irish horses with the Swiss stud book of sport horses and with the Hanoverian stud book. And the presentation she gave us showed that there were some unique genetic markers with the traditional Irish horse, which are normally associated with cognition, good cognition, trainability. And that would certainly tie in with my feeling as a trainer, is that a little bit of Irish draft helps as regards their brain, helps as regards their attitude, helps as regards their trainability. You know, they're good learners, and that's important. The other thing about Irish drafts is we've done some more research, which is also about to be published, which you'll be one of the first to see, on mares in the horses that have represented Ireland internationally, show jumping, and the mares that have represented, the horses that have represented Ireland eventing. And what it clearly shows up is that far from people thinking that the traditional Irish influence has been dying away, it's actually stayed significant. But when you see the paper, you can see the figures.
And what's the time frame?
Since the World Breeding Federation for Sport Horses produced their figures, so that 2004 to the present time,
okay,
which is exciting. And then I was just looking up the top sires of all time that are on the is on the British eventing list. Now that's important because we're talking about not just international horses, we're talking about all the way through the range. And one of the points I'd like to get across tonight is, in terms of sport for all and sport for life, horses are absolutely phenomenal. And unless we look after all the levels of the sport, we're lost. We can't just concentrate on elite level horses. But anyway, looking at leading sires of all time in Britain, number one by a long way is Jumbo. Mm-hmm. So Jumbo, Irish Draft, 50% Irish Draft, 50% Thoroughbred. Number two is Master Imp, 100% Thoroughbred. Number three, Cavalier Royale, who I think opened up a lot of eyes when I first told people that Cavalier Royale actually was 51 or 51.5% Thoroughbred. They didn't realize because people were already looking at
the first generation
breed codes, etc. Number four is Primitive Rising, Thoroughbred. Number five is Fleetwood Opposition, Tricana. Number six is Ricardo Z, who's the lowest level of Thoroughbred, 35%. Seven, Garib. Eight, Cruising, Thoroughbred Irish Draft. Nine, Puissance, Thoroughbred Irish Draft. 10, Fines, who's the
Thoroughbred.
Again, most people, you know, I was doing a lecture and I was talking and I said, then there's this Thoroughbred horse, Fines. And they stood up and said, no, he's not Thoroughbred. He's a Hanoverian. I said, I can assure you he is Thoroughbred.
And he stood in Spain.
but anyway, so in terms of the success story of the Thoroughbred Irish Draft, combination, it is phenomenal, but it's going to disappear. It will disappear unless we tell people about it, sell the idea, and show that it is of value. That there are some the diversification of genes is worthwhile, and it connected with that. A lot of people say to me, "Okay, I buy it about the Irish Draft being suitable to produce a performance horse as regards good attitude." But I don't like the full Thoroughbreds because they're too difficult. And Master Imp, oh, it must be a professional's horse. But if you look at Master Imp's record of the horses that he produced, when you see that he was 3 years leading sire in the World Breeding Federation for Sport Horses, and I think 4 years second, and you see that he's second here in the top horses of all time, you're talking about horses that compete 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 star all the way through. And the only way they can be competitive, the only way they can get these points is to do a good dressage. And they're not going to do a good dressage just by having nice paces. It's because they are trainable. And this reputation, when I first came to Ireland, I lived very close to where he stood. And I was told that Imperius was his sire, was impossible. He didn't want Imperius horses. But the more I researched it, I then found out that Imperius's sire, Hugh Lupus, who produced an absolute top horse himself in Heatherset. They say that he didn't produce any top horses. He certainly did. And he still figures in many pedigrees today. But Hugh Lupus probably was sick and he became distinctly difficult to handle. And I think his reputation passed on to Imperius's reputation, passed on to Master Imp. But certainly as regards my horses, which are my good horses, have been by Master Imp. There's no question their attitude has just been fantastic. So High Kingdom was bomb-proof, absolutely bomb-proof. And it was at an early age when I was in Cornwall that I suppose my attitudes were changed from the people who said that Thoroughbreds were dangerous and stallions were dangerous, which still when I first came to Ireland, a lot of people would tell me these stallions are dangerous. God, and they'd wave them back in the box with their hat and they wouldn't let them out. And
these because they were treated like they were dangerous.
That's right. But I lived in Cornwall, as I said, and we went to Redruth Station to collect two horses. In other words, the horses came down on the train in the days when horses did that.
Yeah.
And it was in 1959, these two horses came down, the two stallions, two chestnut stallions, which my father had organized for a person who was starting out doing Hunters Improvement Society stallions called Jimmy Snell. And my eldest brother was 10. And my sister was 5 years older than that. And this 10-year-old boy and my sister, who riding was not her number one thing in the world, rode these two stallions from Redruth Station to our home, which is about 5 miles away, through the traffic, through the center of the town. And these horses were fine. And it is my experience that if horses do sufficient work and horses are treated as horses and they have a little discipline, but equally they are rewarded for their good behavior, that the vast majority of stallions can be very well behaved. And you might say that it's a different breed, but most of the horses at the Spanish riding school are all stallions. They don't have a problem. And it's perfectly normal now within the dressage world to have more and more stallions.
Do you think, or do you feel, that Ireland's position as the home of the event horse is under threat?
It's certainly under threat statistically, yes. There's a shortage of horses, of those sort of horses. People work with the horses that they've got, and the best riders, and there's some outstanding riders, particularly in Britain, the best riders can produce amazing results from a wide type of horse, if you like. And certainly it is easier for many of the top riders to keep their owners happy and to have a horse that's super easy to do the dressage and is a typical dressage horse and jumps clear in the show jumping. And they have the skills to go around the cross country and they will produce results early on. But talk to all of those people and they will say, if they were looking for their special horse, the horse that would go to a 5-star level, that they need a horse with more gallop and with more blood. And it's not simply a question of them trying to be competitive. It has a huge connection with safety.
I was going to say self-preservation.
Yeah, because the closer a horse goes to its limit, either in jump or in speed, the more risk for an accident that there is. The further away they are from their limit, both in terms of jump and the speed, the more they go well within themselves, the more that they can cope with errors and they're going to be safer. But then there's the other significant thing is that the cross-country speed is at 570 meters per minute. But the cross-country designs have changed to such an extent that you have to spend a significant amount of time going not 570 meters per minute, but going 670 or 700 meters per minute. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
To make
it up
time.
Yeah.
Now, if your horse can only go 700 meters per minute flat out, then not only are you going to be more dangerous, but you're also going to wear that horse out more quickly. It cannot sustain that level for any length of time, and particularly the level of work you have to do to make it fit enough to do that. So it is totally unacceptable to me to see so many horses tired at the end of a 5-star event. You know, I read an interview with Bruce Davidson the other day, and he was saying that one thing he used to complain about at the end of badminton was that the runoff was not sufficiently long, and because the horses were still pulling. Yeah. Bearing in mind they'd done the steeplechase as well, but he said now, you know, there's no problem with the runoff. You know, very few horses come through the finish line with a double handful, and that's not good. And then take it down a few levels. I have absolutely no doubt, and I would defend it to the hilt, that the most important thing is the rider's safety. And it's a wonderful sport, eventing. And there are so many people, the majority of people ride eventing at a relatively speaking low level. The 1-star level is the most popular in international level, just as the same as in show jumping, the 1 and 2-star numerically are where everybody, more people can ride. But if that person is on a horse that is easily making the time, but if they can go around at a speed where the horse is finding it super easy, comfortable, that person is going to be safer. And then connected with that, you need a horse to look after the rider. And the key thing in training your event horse is that they look after you. Now, it's no coincidence that Michael Young, who's the outstanding rider in the world and also a very, very, very good show jumping rider, as you know yourself, from Germany, yeah. It's no coincidence that his horses go so wonderfully across country, normally on what some people would describe as a loose rein, and they wouldn't want it, but it's certainly a very light rein. But he does a lot of work on a loose or light rein on an almost everyday basis at his home, jumping small fences, so that they learn to look after him. And I remember Eddie Macken saying to me when I first came to Ireland that really he was the wrong person to ride his young horses, because he was absolutely incapable of coming down to a fence and putting a horse on a wrong stride or not being on a good stride.
Yeah.
It was just ingrained in him. And he said they had to learn to be slightly wrong and to look after him. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they weren't going to be a winner against the clock. I mean, take Michael Whitaker, and there are all sorts of YouTube videos of him. Wonderful rider against the clock. But he was one of the first people who basically was saying to himself, I'm not worried about being half a stride off a vertical. Now, maybe it's half a stride at the maximum, but I'm not worried about being a bit off when I'm galloping against the clock. My horse has got enough scope. The important thing is to win the class. And there's definitely been a change of style in show jumping, is that people have almost gone back to some of the way the Americans used to ride in the 70s and 80s. There's a freer style now because time is so tight. They have to ride more forwards. And with the courses actually getting smaller, not bigger, most of the horses have sufficient scope, and you can be a little inaccurate and you can still get away with it. And that's what you have to be going across country. You have to be able to come as a fence on an awkward stride because of what's happened. Something's gone slightly wrong. And the horse has to be reading the situation and has to be able to cope.
Yeah, because I wanted to talk about mentality. And I like what we said at the beginning of this. We spend so much time as an industry across all countries assessing the exterior qualities, conformation. We could spend all day debating conformational traits. And it's not that they're not important, but just that there's little to no time goes in to assessing the mentality or the heart and the brain of a horse. And in interview after interview, top horses, what makes them great? It's their mind, it's their heart. So in terms of mentality, what I'm wondering is, as breeders and as producers, how can we better assess and value a horse's mental qualities and not just their physical qualities?
The first thing is to accept that it's important. And certainly the people that you mentioned, I don't disbelieve them, disbelieve you at all. They obviously think that it's very important. But there are quite a large number of people who it's not important to. You know, often as regards selling the horse, it's the way the horse flashes or the way the horse looks, the way the horse steps, that's sufficient. But I think it's super important. I have for many years, and when I say for many years, I'm talking about over 20 years, I have been profiling my horses mentally. So it's rather like linear scoring, except mm-hmm. on the mental side.
Yeah.
So for example, you wouldn't necessarily expect it for the young horse, better if you do, but once you've begun working with the horses should be willing. You know, it's a key thing, is that the horses should be willing. Yeah. So on my mental profile, I have the horse might be on the to the right of my profile, the lower scores. It might be reluctant, or it might actually be stubborn. And on the other side of willing, it's freewheeling or it's racing. That's as an example. So I use...
Will you explain that last bit? Sorry, was it freewheeling or racing?
Freewheeling or racing.
Will you explain what you mean between the two, please?
So a horse's freewheeling is, you know, like a car that's freewheeling down a hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more than willing. It's basically half running away.
Okay.
Are you with me?
Yeah.
So, and its mental attitude is like that all the time. It's half running away. So I have 18 main categories, which I do a mental profile on horses. Now, it's important to do a linear type scoring like this because a horse that's on the quiet side, a horse that's a little bit sleepy, a horse that's a little bit serious maybe, that horse is totally suitable for a more novice rider. And a horse that's too freewheeling or a little freewheeling may require, you know, a rider that's more skillful. But by doing a profile, you can pick out families that have the right traits, particularly from a training point of view. It just, as soon as you think like that, it makes you more observant and more aware on a daily basis. And you say to yourself, well, my horse is not, for example, sufficiently laid back. He's not sufficiently stable in his character. And there are things you can do with a young horse to help them become more stable by making sure that you give them a quiet environment and make sure you expose them to everything gradually. And patience is a great thing, as you know. Time is our biggest enemy. And so many horses that are a little bit fragile mentally have a little bit of a mental explosion, and there's a problem. I'll give you one example of that. A good number of years ago, when I worked for Bordner Goffel, we took a group of horses to Essen Equitana. It was a wonderful bringing together of thousands of horse people and animals of all descriptions. People crowded in everywhere. And they had, I think, what they called the Hot Top Show. And in the Hot Top Show, each stud book or group or country displayed their wares and did a little entertaining show. And it was quite small. It certainly wouldn't have been any bigger than 20 by 40 meters, but it had stands on every side, lots of people. Part of our show, we brought along a wonderful horse of Tom Maloney's, Tom Maloney of Kilkenny, who bred so many fantastic horses. We took along a three-year-old of his, and I jumped it on the lunge. And the horse was, wouldn't have done it if I didn't know the horse was fantastic. He appeared to be laid back, and he was also a great jumper. But after, and in the usual way, I jumped a couple of jumps, then I put on a big rock, so he gave a lovely flash, etc. But then what happened after that caused the problem, because the crowd, full of enthusiasm, erupted.
Okay.
And that next time we brought the horse into the ring the next day, he was a nervous giver. And that horse took ages and ages and ages to become more laid back and more normal again. So, you know, it's an extreme example maybe, but these take a lot of little problems. Little problems build up to be a big problem. But the other thing about which I wanted to tell you about, tell a story about that, I saw I think it was either the Holstein or Hanoverian Stud Book, I don't know. They did the most wonderful display with, you know, 12 magnificent horses and the double ride work and everything else. And there was jumping as well. And they finished up jumping quite a big fence, but not, 5 foot fence, 5 foot wall, which all the crowd were delighted with. And I knew we couldn't match this display that they had given, and we were on after them. So we did the most wonderful thing, because we had Ashfield Bobby Sparrow, yeah. Mary McCann Stallion. Mm-hmm. And so we did our display, which was pretty average, including our lunch horse that we couldn't use anymore in the same way. But we went and brought the house down and got a special award, because our climax of the show was, without any warning, Ashfield Bobby Sparrow just turned with the little boy on top, turned and jumped down. It could have been Philip Dagg, and jumped down and jumped the wall as easily as that.
Yeah.
But
and for anyone that's listening that's not familiar, especially from outside of Ireland, Ashfield Bobby Sparrow was a Connemara pony stallion.
And certainly when I talk about liking all the horses, I love Connemaras. And yeah. I loved Connemaras before I even came to Ireland. And you may know I worked with Karen O'Connor quite an amount, yes. The person who rode Biko, the USET's Horse of the Century, which my brother John found as a three-year-old. The first time I saw her, I arrived at this equestrian center in New England, and I walked, very hot day, and I walked in, and there in front of me was this blonde girl on this 14-2, what I saw, realized straight away it was a Connemara pony. I couldn't believe it. And then I discovered, as I was talking to her, that he was called Erin's Shamrock. You can't get more Irish than Erin's Shamrock. Anyway, she was 14, I think, then, and I taught her for the next 3 years, and I took her to her first open three-day event, including steeplechase and weights, on that same pony, Erin's Shamrock. But the interesting thing about Erin's Shamrock was the first time that I was fully aware that Little Heaven was, I think he had four crosses of Little Heaven. Little Heaven was the thoroughbred horse that was the sire of Stroller and the sire of Dun Drum, and was brought into the Connemara population only for a short amount of time. But it's actually difficult to find a Connemara performance pony without some thoroughbred. And so thinking about thoroughbreds, Carna Dunn, who's so prolific in the Connemara world, is 50% thoroughbred because he's by Little Heaven. Mm. But Carna Dunn is everywhere. Carna Bobby is 25%. The wonderful Grange Finn Sparrow, who I think has sired 20 advanced event horses in the USA, is, I think, between 15 and 20% thoroughbred. Temple Breedy Temple Breedy Fabui, the same thing. So people need to be aware of what thoroughbred blood there is in these populations. Yeah. And I look upon thoroughbred blood as being the great breed improver. And the Connemara thoroughbred cross is one of the most underutilized crosses I think we have for the general sport horse population. Because who are the people who are the majority of riders? They're female, and they're between the ages of 15 and 30, possibly a little bit older, 35. They don't want huge horses, and the pony horse cross works very well, and we have to look after them. And that connects to eventing, because what do these people want to do with their horses? I said that 75% of the international horses are show jumping horses, and that rules the roost of all the international horses, 75%. But if you go down to a lower level, you don't have 75% of the lower level riders wanting to show jump and do dressage. You have 75% wanting to ride out generally, hack out, be a jack of all trades, do riding club, do pony club, whatever it may be. And eventing training is fantastic for that, because if you take an event horse and its skills that it has, it's sensible to do a little dressage, it'll go across country, it'll go through water, and it'll jump a few poles. Now, take it down to a lower level, that's exactly what the pleasure rider wants. It's no accident that all of the coaching systems in the world, there isn't a single one that doesn't make their junior coaches learn about dressage, cross country, and show jumping, even if you want to specialize later on. So it's a foundation sport. These are foundation skills. And the problem is that as people specialize earlier on, both with themselves and with their horses, they lose very important skills. Now, the one that's worried me most of all is inappropriate dressage for event horses, killing their ability to look after themselves, not being safe. But I notice a distinct change now, particularly on the continent. And I had a conversation with Chris Bartle, the British team trainer, mm-hmm. and then the German team trainer a few years ago, saying, well, you know, there are no mares or hardly any mares in dressage at the highest levels. And he said, well, yeah, I suppose it's the way they train them. But just the other day, maybe a week and 2 days ago, they had a major Grand Prix dressage on the continent, and mares were first, second, and third. Isabel Worth has two fantastic mares. So obviously the training has got softer. So Chris Bartle talks about the type of training that's suitable for horse trials. So horse trials can have all sorts of, or the training for horse trials and eventing can have all sorts of benefits for all three disciplines. And it's so important that the horses get out and about. It's so important that the show jumpers and the pure dressage horses have a more normal life, and then they will do better.
And something that I have heard you speak about and read articles with you speaking about it is the importance of a horse's fifth leg. And it's something that I suppose in Ireland we hear a lot. Maybe for some of the international listeners, you might explain or define what you mean by a horse's fifth leg. And then I'm wondering, is it something that is it nature or nurture? Is it something that a horse is distinctly born with? Or is it something that we can train and improve? And the third part of that is, if it's something that we can develop within horses, how as breeders or producers can we improve the horse's fifth leg?
It's both nature and nurture, in my opinion. And it's, as regards the nurture, it's super exciting about the work that Professor Emmeline Hill is undertaking over the next 5 years on epigenetics. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all heard about the genes of a horse and the phenotype of the horse, but very few people have heard of epigenetics. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that there is a strong possibility, the way that the dam affects their foal and the way that we interact with the foal from the earliest times will affect whether we're turning on some genes or turning off some genes. This is a wonderful opportunity for Professor Emmeline Hill, and I think it's Professor Krauss, to do this work. So exciting. So I have my horses turned out on a fairly big area of land that you'll never farm. But it is wonderful for horses. It's up and downhill. You have to go through water in the middle and stuff like that. There is no doubt that the foal is picking up skills about how to cope with these challenges from the earlier stage. Now, you would tell me who it was. Is it Professor Eriksson, Sweden?
Peter Fredriksson's father.
Peter Fredriksson
is involved. Has been involved with it in Sweden, yeah.
Now, he showed me his work. I saw the film of his work, etc. So he had quite a herd of horses, and there's a big difference. I mean, I only have a few horses. He had a herd of horses, and he fed them in different places in a big area, and there were obstacles between the different areas, and so they all had to travel over the obstacles. But it was obvious from the start, when you saw the film, that some of the youngsters were panicking. And there was a lot of hustle and bustle and squashing, and more like a hunting situation, if you like, with a large field of people. And they wanted to go over the same fence in the same place. So they weren't learning good technique. They were doing the reverse. They were learning bad habits, and they were panicking. Now, I think he has said subsequently that it didn't work. You know, it didn't improve their ability. But I do believe that if the horse goes slow enough and is in a situation where they are challenged a degree as opposed to a small degree as opposed to a huge degree, then I think that it's particularly valuable. So, for instance, I have a yard outside my an open yard outside my stabling shed. I don't keep horses in single stables, which is another thing which I'd like to get more people to think about, different stabling systems. But just very simply, the gate into the field from the yard, I have two sleepers. Mm-hmm. So they go over those two sleepers. And I think that there is no doubt that by going over these, and I have to go into the top field, they have to go up a little bank and down a little bank. I think that that is of value. But basically what you're doing is you're getting the horse to look after you. So there's what I call a contract between the horse and the rider. The rider is expected to do certain things. The horse is expected to do certain things. So I would never say put the horse in too much trouble. But when you're training and schooling and the fences are small, fairly solid, get the right direction and the right speed and then leave the rest to the horse. And so from the start, the horse is learning to develop what I call its fifth leg, because in moments of trouble, it's got something, it can produce something, a fifth leg, a reaction that will solve a particular problem. Now, loose jumping can be connected to this and can be very, very good as long as the fences don't get too big. So I am horrified still by some of the loose jumping because, first of all, it's all done on the left rein. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's on the lunge or loose jumping. It's all done on the left rein. And people are not sufficiently aware about whether the two hind legs are together. So as a horse gets to its limit and you're asking it more and more, it will push more off its stronger leg than its weaker leg. In the same way that when I was brought up in Cornwall with the banks, young horses go very slowly into banks, most of the time trotting, but the banks sometimes are very tall. And it's physically too much of an effort. And so they push off their stronger leg to get to the top of the bank rather than pushing off the two hind legs together. And then they get a curb on that stronger leg because of the effort made to go up the bank. So you don't see curbs very often these days, but certainly it's something we saw a lot of in Cornwall. Before you had loose jumping, everybody lunged over a fence just on the left rein. I've always lunged on both reins. And I always make sure that I don't get to a size that makes the horse struggle so much that they end up jumping crooked across the fence because they're jumping off their stronger hind leg and their stronger side. And it will happen with all horses. And then if you're going to jump a bigger fence, you need to be at a good spot. Otherwise, you're going to frighten the horse. So I talked about Michael Whitaker. He was quite happy to come in and let the horse decide for himself and cope for itself, even going faster speed, doing the level of competition he was doing. It's fine. I loose jump. I go over fences that are smaller with the horses and I do as little as possible for them. And I say, your responsibility is to look after me. I can't do the jumping for you. But if the fence gets bigger or anywhere close to their limit, then you need to be spot on. And putting one pole on the ground at a certain distance away from the fence is not sufficient. You need to engineer it so that the horse can really come to the right spot. Otherwise, the horse becomes frightened. I like Ted Edgar's schooling, so that I wondered what all the very, very, very thin poles were doing, broken about the place, like firewood. And he said, I don't let any customer jump a big fence unless we use those poles, which were literally about an inch diameter, no more, so that the horse never got a fright. Mm. And it's so easy to give a horse a fright. So the fifth leg is about, my side of the contract is to give the horse the right direction, the speed. The horse's side of the contract is to look at the fence and to take certain decisions. But it's working within a frame, if you like, not just leaving it absolutely all to the horse.
Yeah. There's another theme that has come up a few times, and you refer to it as the idea of the horse, the importance of the hotel that a horse goes to.
Yes.
And again, I'm wondering, could you explain a bit by what you mean by that, but also then as breeders with that importance in mind,
Are there ways in which we can positively influence that aspect of a horse's life?
It's such a difficult thing, but it's so important. It's so important. Now, there's a reason, if we're talking about eventing, there is a reason why Richard Sheyn is so successful. It's because he has invested in wonderful riders to prepare his horses. And it is a major investment. Carol G, the Fernhill horses, is exactly the same. So horses are first-time learners. What happens to them all the way through their life from the earliest is important. Now, when they're foals and they are yearlings, the most important thing is that they are peaceful. The most important thing is that they have a life which is comfortable for them, and they can move around. And the moving around is super important, absolutely crucial. You probably met Michael Osborne, the national stud.
I know of him, but I can't say that I've met him.
I say this because it shows you why it's so important. I think it was the last lecture he ever gave before he died, and it wasn't long before he died. And he stood up in a hotel in Cork, and normally he was just a wonderful raconteur. This time he hardly said anything because he just stood up and he said, "I have one message for you tonight. Turn your mares and young stock out," and sat down because he wasn't well. But I'll never forget that message, and it's so true. Horses need to move. Horses need to exercise. And I believe a big part of the problem that we have with our horses is that we put riders on them before they're coming through their backs, which I've mentioned already, and we put riders on them that are too heavy. So I believe that young horses should do work, but we should bear in mind that the growth plates in the back are the last ones to close up. The growth plates at the wither is the very last one, but it's the growth plates in the back which, you know, we have to be so careful about. But horses, they shouldn't spend that their yearling and two-year-old years doing absolutely nothing. They need to move, they need to have exercise, they need to develop their coordination. That's super important. Then when we begin to work them, lunging skills are super important. And I know traditionally people did young horses without lunging, they did it with driving. But driving is largely done in walk. And as regards engaging the back, it's really difficult to engage the back in walk and really difficult long reining. There are some wonderful people with great skills doing this, but it is not an easy thing to do. Whereas if you lunge them and you're a good lunger, it's much easier to get them to come through the back. You don't have to lunge them for hours and hours, and that would be a totally bad thing to do. And certainly when people talk about lunging, people say to me, well, they don't want a small circle. And I totally agree. One of the biggest problems we have with our young horses is that we school them in areas that are too small. They need to be bigger. We need to ride them out and about. We need to ride them on the road. That's super good. Trotting up the hills is super good. But Jack LaGoff used to lunge them one day, ride them the next, lunge them one day, ride them the next. I think that was a good system. And you need to be just as good lunging to the right as you are to the left. And of course, the vast majority of people are much better lunging to the left than they are to the right, which is the same reason why they loose jump them just to the left. And it's very important that you understand that the acceptance of the bit relates to the way they're going from behind. So key bits are not necessary. I'll give you an example of that boomerang with Eddie Macken. Rode in his hackamore, rode in his bitless bridle, show jumping. He got a white mouse. You don't need a bit to get a white mouse. So sometimes, if I have a horse with wolf teeth and I've taken them out, or the horse has got a mouth injury because it's been sent for retraining or something, I will work the horse without a bit, and it can get a white mouth in the same way as you do with a bit. So that has to be an understanding. And the riders need to have a really, really good rising trot. And it's no good going out and walk on the roads for hour upon hour, because all you're doing is putting the weight in one place and the horse will drop his back. So you want to walk and trot on the road, and you want to trot up the hills, but with the rider in a balanced seat and with the horse between the aids. In other words, connected from the back end to the front end.
What was the path for both Mandiba and High Kingdom, from their young lives in Enniskerry to Zara Phillips, then Tyndall, and to Karen O'Connor.
Mandiba didn't go to Karen until he was a four-year-old. He was the ideal because he was confident, willing, but not run away in any way. He had a good balance of qualities. He was like his mother. So when he was four, he went to Karen, and she suited him ideally. They got on very well. So therefore, as a five-year-old, he started competing seriously. He won his first one star as a six-year-old, his first two stars as a seven-year-old, his first three star as an eight-year-old, and went to the Olympics as a nine-year-old. But there's the problem. He should have waited a year. You know, he was young.
Okay.
And it was a difficult situation. He won almost every single event he went into up until that stage. And then the following year, she brought him to badminton, and had a problem at the Normandy Bank, and I think she actually got off without doing her air vest. The air vest exploded, and the horse went over backwards down over the Normandy Bank. He did compete thereafter and competed well, but not at the highest sort of level.
And with High Kingdom then, did he go straight to Zara?
Both horses were bought sight unseen, and that's another thing I tell people, not to pat myself on the back, but to say we can build up trust between the breeders, the producers, and the end users. You know, you can save a lot of problems and make it much easier to find homes, suitable homes for your horses.
That's something that we can't emphasize enough. And I've had these conversations with my dad, and when I was deciding, do I move home? Is Sligo a suitable base? You come up with all the excuses, you're too far out of the way and all this. But what I've realized is a lot of what I am selling, I'm selling sight unseen like that. And sometimes people will ring you and you'll have a horse for sale and you need the money. But you tell them the truth and the whole truth. And what I always feel is if the truth loses the deal, let the deal be lost. Because then I have people buying foals from different countries, people that I've never met. They're buying sight unseen. But I always take the approach that the only surprises I want them getting are that the horse is better than they thought. And yeah, it's amazing what can be created when you really like hone in on a high level of transparency and honesty with people. And it makes everyone's life and job so much easier, more efficient, more enjoyable.
Deliver more than you promise.
Yes.
Deliver more than you promise. It's part of the philosophy for what I call Team Ireland. But to take a step back, in the early parts, in the spring of when he was three, High Kingdom was turned out near Powers Court House. And I got a call on the telephone to say that he jumped out and he was on the pristine piece of green grass outside the house. And when I drove very quickly there, he was surrounded by a lot of men waving their arms and making more of a mess on the grass.
Yeah. Because
of it. So thankfully, he saw me and I was able to go to him. I didn't have any feed, but he was a very quiet horse. I went and got him, walked down, opened the gate, turned him back where he'd been. Now, to jump out, he had to jump not only over a ha-ha, you know, a ditch-like thing. He also had a fence above the ha-ha. So you're talking about 4'6", 5 foot, plus the ha-ha ditch. So he jumped out of there and I could see his footsteps and I was pretty impressed. And I turned him out and I turned around. And as I got onto the roadway, I heard this clip-clip because the ground was quite firm. And I turned around and there he was trotting to the ha-ha and he jumped out as sweet as a nut to join me. And boy, was I happy. And he continued to jump out, even with Zara, and without a problem, from paddock to paddock, from high rail, stud rail to high rail, stud rail. And then I started to work him. And when I jumped, I would jump all my young horses just to assess them. And he was never on the wrong leg. He never did a bad jump. He did a jumper's jump. And so then I had to say to myself, well, this horse should really be a jumper. And I said, well, you know, most of the other horses are going to be event horses, but I should have sold them as a jumper. And it was after 2012 games, the various reports that came out, but he jumped two magnificent rounds, but in the first round, there was a real communication problem and he crashed through one fence, which proved to be very expensive from his individual medal hopes. But his second round, he was just playful. He was just exquisite. And Richard Jeffery, who you might have come across, is an international course builder, and he always builds at Babington and Burley. He wrote in Horse and Hound that that was a jumper. And I'm like, damn. but that might, I think if you can breed a horse that can be, which a top event horse is, do a high-level dressage, high-level cross-country, high-level show jumping, then to me that's a really exciting and good thing. And then you take it down a peg or two and say you breed those horses in miniature, then they're a horse for the industry. And that's why eventing is so important. I spoke to Richard Jeffery just yesterday because I wanted to confirm some facts and figures, because people keep saying to me that you can't sell a horse like High Kingdom as a jumper because he was 15th, 16th thoroughbred, and you won't get a thoroughbred jumping the bigger fences that they have today. And it's important to understand that the fences are not bigger today. They may be more technical and you may have to go faster, but they're not bigger. And if you have to go faster, then surely you want a horse with quality. And I was just double checking on some stuff. And they always talk about the Mexico, Munich and Montreal Olympics being the biggest show jumping tracks ever. The verticals were 180. The oxes were 220 wide. Now, after these three Olympics, after the next four Olympics, they changed the rules. And you can only have these days 2 meters wide, although even at the World Equestrian Games, this last time in America, all of the oxes were 1.80 meters. There's a big difference between 1.80 meters and 2.20 meters in terms of width. And in terms of height, 1.80 meters, whereas now what you get is 1.60 meters. Even in the World Equestrian Games, you've got two verticals that are 1.65 meters.
Yeah.
And what I would strongly suggest is that go on to Alan Wade's Facebook page. Alan Wade, now from Ireland, the world's best course builder. And not only is he the world's best course builder, he puts up all his tracks, all the heights, all the distances on his Facebook page. And you can go there and it confirms what I was saying about the World Equestrian Games. Now, on the commentary for the World Equestrian Games, they said they're coming down to this enormous final vertical in the second round. And they said it's 1.85 meters. Well, it's 1.65 meters, which is a big difference. So when they were jumping these huge fences in Mexico, what type of horse won? But a thoroughbred, Snowbound, who actually was found by an Irishman. What was second? But Stroller, the Connemara thoroughbred cross from Ireland. What was third? Mr. Softy, who I failed to find his breeding, but he was definitely Irish, but he's like a typical three-quarter bred, the best of the Irish horses. He was a double for Kilbaha in terms of a type of horse, Mr. Softy, ridden by David Broom. You then come to the next Olympics at Munich. Who won the gold medal? But Ambassador with Graziano Mazzanelli, the horse which Tommy Brennan had. Bred in Waterford, classic three-quarter bred horse. What had the silver medal? But Sarn with Anne Moore, who again didn't have papers, but it was almost certainly thoroughbred. Bronze medal, Sloopy, thoroughbred. You go to Montreal, and there is the only time a warm blood came to the fore at this period of time was Warwick Rex with Alwyn Schockemola, and he won the gold medal. But two thoroughbreds, Branch County and a French horse, were silver and bronze medal. Then you go to Los Angeles, where the fences were still bigger than current Olympic Games, and the distances, Richard was giving me the distances. They had a combination with the maximum width on the three fences plus long distances in between with a triple bar in the middle. And he said 34 horses failed to get through clear through the combination, so how difficult it was. But the gold medal was thoroughbred, Touch of Class, Abdullah second, Holly Mount.
Anthony Sheridan's. Yeah.
Yeah. So Chillout's got some good event horses. Jessica, bred in Ireland, the mare, with Heidi Robbiani, got the bronze medal, again, three-quarter bred. Then go to Seoul, what won in Seoul, and the distances of these courses was also long, but Chapelou, who's virtually a thoroughbred, Jem Twist, thoroughbred, and then there was a German, Carsten Hock, who was third, and everybody said, well, he was branded, wasn't he? So he was a typical warm blood. He was 7/8 thoroughbred. So what I'm saying is that the biggest tracks ever, those were all thoroughbreds. And people say to me, well, a thoroughbred can only jump through speed. Well, it can jump through speed. It can jump 5 meters of water. And every single time in classy steeplechases, it's jumping not just 5 meters, it's jumping 6 and 7 meters in terms of from start, from takeoff to landing. And the steeplechase fences have to be 1.40 meters high. And all of the high jump records are held by thoroughbreds. The world record by a horse called Wasso from Chile is thoroughbred. There's a horse called, I think, Heather Bloom, who jumped over 8 foot 3 times in America. So in terms of sheer scope, it's not beyond the powers of reason to think that we could find thoroughbred horses that have got the jump as well as these other qualities, because that's, to my mind, in terms of Team Ireland, if we can produce jumpers with enough quality that they can gallop and therefore be eventers as well, then we're really winning.
But I think there needs to be a major transformation of how we'll call it, approve those thoroughbred stallions that become available to the sport horse industry. Because when you have a system where you can be approved based on your time form, it's just a system destined to fail. And there's overall, in terms of the thoroughbreds that are available for the sport horse industry in Ireland, there is such a lack of an athleticism assessment that it's understandable why more breeders won't maybe take the chance or try to use them. And then because they don't get the numbers, they never get the chance to be proven. And we deem them all failures or whatever term you want to put on it. But if the system first was designed in a way that tested and showcased which ones had the athletic traits that we desired and which ones didn't, it would save everybody a lot of time, and those with the desirable traits would get more support.
I totally agree with you. The only rider I would add is that, which is why I talked about the Holstein horse that's been approved, is I have now 147 Grand Prix pure thoroughbred horses from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s largely. And it's a difficult job going through trying to find their breeding. But it seems, and then also going through the breeding of these top event horses, it does seem that the horses that are Derby winners are the highest class 1.5 mile horses, or even St. Ledger type horses, 1.75 mile horses. It does seem that those stallions have a much higher strike rate. And I think it's exciting that that horse that's been approved by the Holstein Verband has got such genes that are very close to top level 1.5 mile horses. When I started the exercise, I thought that sprinters would be more prevalent, but there are very few sprinters that are prevalent. There's a horse called Gold Bridge who's a sprinter, who figures in a lot of these jumping pedigrees. But otherwise, you come back in terms of root genes, you come back to particularly two horses, Hyperion and Precipitation. And obviously Precipitation and Furioso. Furioso is a god in the warm blood world. Yeah.
And going back to the Olympic theme for a moment, earlier on this evening, I was trying to think if I knew anybody in the horse world who had passed 5 horses, and correct me if there's more, but at least 5 horses through your hands, 2 that you bred and 3 that were sourced between yourself and your brother, that have gone on and competed at the Olympic Games. Mandiba, High Kingdom, Custom Made, Gilt Edge and Biko, which in itself is a phenomenal achievement for anyone.
Thank you.
And what I'm wondering is, out of all the days that you have watched all those horses, either the ones that you bred or sourced, and actually I forgot to mention Harbour Pilot didn't go to the Olympics, but Harbour Pilot won 2 medals at the Pan American Games, and so he's worth mentioning there as well.
I was very fond of Harbour Pilot. He was christened William, as you probably might know, so that's also sad of you.
That's nice.
There is a very good example. William was very fragile mentally, and I spent about 6 months with him before he went to the States. And undoubtedly, you know, in my opinion, that 6 months was very important so that he didn't have some sort of mental collapse, some sort of burnout when he first traveled in a plane and went across the States. So it's recognizing individual horses' traits.
Out of those five or six horses, and there's a lot of World Equestrian Games outings in the mix as well, what has been the most memorable moment or event for you watching any of those horses that you bred or sourced? Is there a particular day that stands out above the rest?
Well, I've already mentioned one is High Kingdom's cross country at the 2012 Olympics.
Yeah.
And in 2010, I went to the WEG in Kentucky and Mandeba's cross country round again for sheer class. I even hugged David O'Connor, which is not a thing that you that happens every day of the week. It was just class, and to see horses that you produced yourself going at that level with that level of ease, it's just wonderful. And in relation to that, both horses were doing it in a very willing way. I genuinely mean that if horses are very tired at the end of the cross country and they're no longer willing, that the riders should pull up, and if they don't, they should get red cards or yellow cards, whatever it is. But overall, this business of willingness is a central part of wanting our horses, our young horses, to be calm, forwards, and straight. The forwardness, the willingness, they're together. And that's the other reason for liking the Connemara, the Irish Draft, and the Thoroughbred in particular, because with the Thoroughbred, their job is to put their head first past the post. And if you breed from horses that have that sort of willingness to gallop and push themselves at the end of the race, you will get those characteristics coming out in their offspring by and large. And I've been involved with too many horses that are unwilling, too many horses that aren't very generous. And I think as regards Ireland, this is something we can really build on, because it's not a story. This is fact. We need to show in all of the disciplines, and in hunting, and in pony club, and in riding club, there's the most amazing work that's going on with the normal average rider on horses that are willing. And as you know yourself, if they're unwilling, those riders are not going to be able to have a happy day or make them go. As regards being a winner against the clock, or going across country, or even riding a Grand Prix dressage test, those sort of characteristics are very important. Spencer Wilton, who was a dressage model for my book and also was in the British team in the 2012 Olympics, the British dressage team, he did an article in the Horse and Hound last year, and he says when he goes in to do a Grand Prix test, all he concentrates on is the right direction and the right speed. And so he puts his horse in canter, they keep cantering until he tells them not to. He puts the horses into one-time flying changes, they keep doing one-time flying changes until he tells them not to. That's the attitude. And take that down to lower level riders, it makes riding so much fun. Riding is a sport for all and a sport for life. Riding is life enhancing. And a lot of that is lost because of the enormous money in show jumping and the enormous pressure there is in elite level sport. And we have to make sure that we safeguard the whole sport, the whole sport.
You've coached a lot of riders of all ages across several years. Which of your students have you learned the most from? Or has there been any one student that made you question or challenge a preconceived idea that you had when you started working with them?
Every student will challenge you. And it's very important not to have too many preconceived ideas. So you start off from the standpoint that you listen to the student. In the same way as when you're training a horse, you start off from listening to the horse. And at the end of the day, our task is to make that rider or that horse independent. Independence links to fifth leg. So a good coach, it's not how much you have to do for your student, it's how much you don't have to do for your student, how much they do for themselves. In the same way, it's just talking about with the horse, a good trainer of a horse, when you go up to the competition, you should have to do very little, except some key things. So picking out people is often misleading.
Yeah.
But I have the greatest admiration for Aidan Keogh. Mm-hmm. He's has been on the long list to go to the Tokyo Olympics, despite the fact that he only has one horse, and he won't mind me saying, is in his 50s now, and runs a business. So he's doing it very much on an amateur basis, of which there are very few people riding at that level on an amateur basis. A lot of this game is about belief, and he's always been very talented. He took a lot of time off, and this the team training he's been doing and riding alongside in close proximity to the best riders that we have, it has confirmed that he is a very talented rider. So if you like, the job that I did there was very little apart from to encourage him to go along and partake of that training.
That brings me on actually beautifully to another point, and that belief, and to talk about positivity. And it's something you mentioned earlier in the interview, and I'm glad that you did, because for me, for as long as I've known you, you're someone who always comes across as a very positive force in the industry, and you seem to make a very conscious effort to spread that. And it could be simple things. It could be just a word of encouragement to somebody. It could be something as simple as a Facebook post. It's so easy to scroll by something and to not engage or to not like it or anything like that. And it's not that we have to go around socially validating each other, but it's that you take the time to consciously leave a positive comment or message just to give someone that little nudge along. And there seems to be a reluctance, maybe it's human nature, but in the industry, to actually support and encourage or congratulate people. Is cultivating that positivity something that is an ongoing process for you? Are you very conscious of creating that positivity?
Yeah, I am. It's part of what I was talking about at the start about Team Ireland. I think it's so important. You know, some people just can't resist a snide comment. Some people can't resist getting into a whole litany of negativity. But so what I do is I actively try and be very positive. And people say, well, all you're doing is telling the people what they want to hear. All you're doing is ignoring the facts. But I look at it as a yin and yang of possibilities and realities. So I'm always talking about the possibilities. And as soon as you focus your mind on the possibilities, you actually see a direction of where they should go. But you can't find that direction until you first look at the realities of the situation. So I never ignore the realities, but I would always try and go for what I perceive to be the realities to say, well, there's a movement there. There's somewhere where that person can go. Now, over a period of time, you would be clearer to that person about the realities of the situation. But I don't go straight in there with the realities of the situation because it would put most people off.
Yeah.
And trust is developed because people know that you, as far as possible, tell them the truth. So you have to balance. They can't exist without each other, the possibilities and the realities. And they always go together in the same way as effort and delight must go together. You know, sometimes the sessions, you know, you have to work hard. There's no doubt that if you want to be an elite rider, trainer, whatever, there's a lot of hard work involved. But if there's not delight, then you soon lose heart. And if you lose heart, you won't be going anywhere. So there has to be effort and delight. I mean, I was very impressed with David Mullins, who just retired as a jockey, won the Grand National at the age of 19. And he said his heart wasn't in it. So he's super talented, no doubt. Could be a champion jockey in the future, but his heart wasn't in it. And I respect that very much. If your heart's not in it, go in a different direction. And equally, there are people who are not so talented, but their heart really is in it, really is in it. They really want to do something. And then that's wonderful because in the horse world, you can say, we're going to find the right horse. We're going to work with a good program. And with that attitude, you can go a long, long way. And that's why I say that even at elite level, horse riding can be something for life. And there'll be other Aidan Keoghs riding at the age of 50. And Ben Miller. Ian Miller.
I mean, Captain Canada.
What an inspiration, you know, still riding like a young man, you know, at his age, with his 70s.
Well into well into his 60s.
66,
I think has done more Olympics than any other active show jumper in the world. The other thing I think that's something that we're too reluctant to do, particularly, so from a breeder point of view, is to congratulate or put the spotlight on other breeders' successes. And I don't know why that is. I don't know, is it that we deem the success of other breeders as taking something away from us? I enjoy pointing out someone succeeding. And it's the same doing these interviews. I go around and I profile successful breeders and I share that with other breeders. And regularly social media channels or whatever, I try and just acknowledge the person who created this horse that has just achieved something special. I can't look back at the years of doing that and say that that's taken something away from what I'm doing, or that I'm, it's actually done the opposite.
No, by promoting success, you promote yourself in terms of Team Ireland. So the more the good news stories can get out, the better. When people realize that what's going on in Ireland is fantastic, and I'm not talking just about the horses, I'm talking about the whole industry. Cultural, mm-hmm. the whole cultural thing and the whole industry, then people want to be associated with that.
Yeah.
And I think getting the right attitude of mind is so very important. And also celebrating, you know, you might be into show jumping, you might be into eventing, but equally you could be into dressage. And that's a whole area where we there's huge potential. But, you know, there are so many other activities and we need to celebrate diversity. I mean, I think, you know, Susan Oates, who yeah. got the world high jump record riding side saddle
yeah.
and goes racing side saddle. Well, good on her. That's part of the Irish success story, and her joie de vivre, her overall enthusiasm is fantastic. And I think we should look at celebrating people who do unusual things with horses.
Before I get on to my final question, is there anything else that I should have asked you and I didn't? Or is there anything else that you feel is important for us to discuss before I move on to the last question?
I have a structure I call the Go Rules, which is to encourage people to give them a structure so they can make the most of their situation, particularly for younger people, which I think will have a longer lasting legacy than much of what I've done with the coaching and with the horses, with the pure coaching and the horses. The first rule is just simply have a go. And so that fits with the positivity. Second rule is have another go. Do it better, but probably involve some other people, involve a coach, involve Team Ireland, you know, get help. The third one is produce the goods. In other words, eventually, whatever you do, you need to do it well. And the fourth one is goal set, because once you're doing things well, you have to decide what your goal is, whether it's riding bareback or riding side saddle or going to the Olympics, whatever it is. And the last one is to be the governor. You have to ride your own race. It comes back to independence, which we've come up with a lot. You have to go follow a road that you're happy with. And at the end of the day, you're in charge. Now, many coaches fall foul of this. They fall down because they want to be the governor all the time. But you have to let your student be the governor. And that's just so important. And the other thing that I suppose will outlive anything I've done is the Micklem Bridle, and I hope the Micklem Girth will do the same, because genuinely most people didn't understand about the different widths of the two jaws of a horse, how much wider the upper jaw is, and they didn't understand about the infraorbital nerve comes out immediately under where a crank noseband would go. So if you put a crank noseband on, you are numbing those nerves, and those are the nerves which are servicing the area where you have the bit, the area around the nose of the horse. So crank nosebands make the horses numb around the bit area, and it's one of the main reasons why the Micklem Bridle is a success. But pointing out those two things and producing a type of horse equipment that gives a more humane option is so important. And we should celebrate that as part of the Irish story. We really should. It's part of the Irish story, grabbing hold of every little piece that we can to say, yeah, we are a special land of the horse. We have huge advantages.
The governor point as well is something that's quite important. The running your own race. I find, even bringing it back to the breeder perspective, and a lot of the majority of the listeners are breeders, some are breeders and riders. So often, I think we breed what others think we should, or what we think others think we should, rather than breeding what we want to or believe in. And I really wish that more breeders would have, I don't know, the confidence to breed what they feel is right. Nobody will know their mare better than them. Nobody knows their situation better than them. Nobody knows their desires, their dreams and aspirations better. So I would really wish that even from a breeder point of view, that more breeders would run their own race, because there's been lots of examples over the years where I've been doing something, breeding to a particular stallion, and people think that you've lost your mind. They can't see the logic. He's too unproven. He's this. But the only person that needs to be happy with it is yourself. I'm not looking to make the rest of the world happy. I just want to do what feels right to me. And more often than not, if not every time, they've worked and they've sold to good people, or they've been financially viable or brought profit, or whatever objective measurements that you want to put on it, they have delivered those. And I don't know where I would have ended up if I had listened to all the opinions of everyone else. And I think some of the greatest satisfaction that I take in my own situation is that I've ran my own race. And yeah, I'd love to see more people doing it.
But if I dare, I agree with you, but there's another side to that coin. I agree with you to the extent that you started your own race fairly well on down the racetrack. You had a lot of background knowledge. You had a lot of exposure in your situation to elements of horse breeding. There certainly is the quickest way to learn is to ride your own race, and you take responsibility for that. But the other side of that is there are a number of horses that are bred which are unsuitable for a use. Mm-hmm. If a horse is unsuitable for a use, then it's a problem within the industry. And horses that are unsuitable for a use end up in some unpleasant situations.
Circumstances, yeah.
So again, I look upon it as part of the overall picture. But the key point, which you're highlighting very nicely, is you're going to get much more satisfaction, and you're going to have a journey which pleases you much more if you ride your own race.
So finally, what advice would you offer to a young breeder, or just to someone at the start of their breeding career?
Everybody is so different. First of all, you need to listen and talk and find out what sort of personality that they are. There is always value in going to the best. So when I first wanted to do dressage to a high level, and I had to stay in England, there are only two people who regularly produce Grand Prix dressage horses. I was intent on going to one of those two people. It would have been, relatively speaking, a waste of my time if I went to a lower level person who hadn't finished learning their trade themselves. And so I would say the same to most people: get exposure from somebody who really knows their business, and ask lots of questions. You don't have to do it for, you know, a lifetime. You know, you are standing on the shoulders of giants, and you can't get away from that. Now, having stood on the shoulders of giants, you will then reevaluate what you want to do, which direction you want to go in. It might not be for you. You might want to go into a different direction. First of all, a little education. Secondly, you give it a go wholeheartedly. And as you give it a go, ride your own race, then you'll learn a lot. Bear with me, but I'm going to recite a little poem and I'll explain why afterwards. It's called Quartet. It's about a racehorse, a war horse, a pony, and a donkey. The dashing racehorse, head on high, told of his triumphs. There was I, balked at the brook, but in the straight I showed them how to carry weight. The war horse rolled a fiery eye, dreaming of battles, there was I. The equine tank, ah, chivalry, the very name revolves round me. The pony tossing tangled mane, neighed, ere they bred you, I was there. When man chased mammoth neath the sky and painted caverns, there was I. The donkey pricked his patient ears as memories drifted down the years, then spoke. I heard a child's first cry, and by his manger, there was I. So what it's all about is individuality. We're all different, and all of our horses are different. Treat yourself as an individual, and treat your horses as individuals.